Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the University of Southern Maine Role of Training in the CFSR conference call. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. If Ms. Holly Sanger or Ms. Linda Mitchell is on the call, could you please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone, please? I would now like to introduce your host for today's presentation, Ms. Susan Kinnack. Ms. Kinnack, you may begin, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Howard. I want to welcome all of you to the first call that the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement has ever done specifically for child welfare training administrators. I'm Susan Kinnack, and I do work for the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, which is housed at the Muskie School in Portland, Maine, and I'm so glad you could join our call. The National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement is part of the Children's Bureau Training and Technical Assistance Network. Organizations in this network help build the capacity of state, local, tribal, and other public child welfare agencies to achieve safety, permanency, and well-being for children and families. Since 2002, our resource center has been working extensively with child welfare training administrators across the country. As some of you know, we sponsor a peer training network, have published a training system assessment guide for child welfare agencies, and we provide technical assistance to many states, counties, and tribes around the country around training system issues. Recently, when I was on site working in a New England state, I was asked by the child welfare training director if there were ever opportunities for child welfare training administrators or directors to get together to talk about topics of mutual interest. A top issue of his was the CFSR. Thus, the idea for today's call was born. You may be wondering how you received an invitation to be on this call. We invited individuals identified by the state child welfare director as training administrators or folks who registered as such at the recent Children's Bureau conference for agencies and courts. So that's how we found you, and that's how we invited you to join us, and we're so happy you're here with us today. Our call today focuses on the second round of the CFSR and PIP process from a training perspective. As you know, the first round of the CFSR heightened the importance of training in advancing organizational and practice improvements that agencies are undertaking to achieve better outcomes for children and their families. As we move into the second year of the second round, it seemed timely to ask the Children's Bureau and some training administrators from states that have already gone through the second review to talk with us about their experiences. So today, we're pleased to have on the line with us Linda Mitchell from the Children's Bureau CFSR unit, Holly Sanger, training administrator from the Arizona Division of Children, Youth, and Families, and Michelle Rosenberg, training administrator from DC Child and Family Services Agency. Before we get into that discussion, however, I want to do a roll call and find out who is on the call from each of the states. So, Howard, I think you're going to have to unmute the lines.
Lines are open, ma'am.
Thank you very much. So I'll remind you all we're unmuted. I can hear every single word you're saying or if you're shuffling papers. So we will go through, and what I want to do is go region by region and have you introduce yourself by giving your name and the agency you work for. And I hope we'll see that there's a nice cross-section of states and federal regions on the call with us today. So let's start with Region 1. Is anyone on the call from Maine, Rhode Island, Vermont, New Hampshire, or Connecticut?
Bruce Rollins, Director of the Child Welfare Institute in Rhode Island, and Jan Smith, who's a training specialist, Rhode Island Child Welfare Institute.
Hi, Bruce. Hi, Jan. Glad you could join us. Anyone else from Region 1? Okay. Let's go to Region 2, which is New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. Anyone on from those states? Okay. Let's go into Region 3. How about Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, D.C.?
Pennsylvania's here. I'm Tina Weber with the Pennsylvania Child Welfare Training Program. And with me is Katie Davis, our department lead for curriculum, and Lynn Keltz, who oversees our practice improvement initiative.
Glad you could join us. Michelle, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Michelle Rosenberg. I'm the training administrator at Child and Family Services Agency in the District of Columbia.
Thanks, Michelle. Anyone else? West Virginia, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware?
Susan, this is Donna Hornsey with Central Office of the Children's Bureau. Not sure if you wanted us to jump in.
Donna, anytime you want to jump in is fine with me. Glad you're on the call. Okay, let's move on to Region 4, which is Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, Florida, and Georgia.
South Carolina, I'm Hazel Parker. I'm the training director for the State Department of Social Services. And I have Irvin Bond, the assistant director in charge of human services training.
Welcome. Glad you could be on the call.
From Kentucky,
this is Debbie Deaver. I'm the associate director from the Training Resource Center at ECU,
and also our training specialist, Debbie Varnamy, is on the line.
Hi, Debbie, and Debbie, glad to have you join us.
Hello.
This is Francie Hill from Georgia, Department of Human Resources, Education and Training Section. I'm a project administrator at the state office.
Delighted you could be on the call with us today. Thank you. Tennessee, North Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, or Florida?
Yeah, this is Matthew Class from Florida's Department of Children and Families. I'm the Chief of Policy and Training in the Family Safety Program Office.
Hi, Matthew. Glad you got my email.
Yeah, thank you much.
Welcome up to the call. Anyone else from Region 4? Okay, Region 5, which is Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, Ohio, and Indiana.
Minnesota. Richard Dean, I'm the Child Welfare Training Supervisor for the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
Hi, Dick. Glad you could join our call.
Glad to be here.
Good to hear your voice.
Hi, this is Ohio. We have several people here. Joan Van Hull will be joining us soon.
And do you want to tell us who you are?
Oh, this is Rhonda Aubin, Adoptions, and Dorothy Hughes, Julie Worth. We've got several people here.
Okay, well, let me just say hello to Ohio.
Thank you.
Glad you could join us. Anybody from Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, or Indiana? Okay. Region 6, which is New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, or Louisiana.
Susan, this is Rebecca Bogard with the Oklahoma Child Welfare Training Section.
Hi, Rebecca. It's always good to hear your voice.
Hi, Susan.
This is Laura Guerra from Louisiana Department of Social Services, Office of Community Services, as the interim training administrator for the state of Louisiana.
Glad you could join us today, Laura. Anybody else from Region 6, New Mexico, Texas, or Arkansas?
Yeah, Susan, this is Andrea Poole. I'm with the Protective Services Children, Youth, and Families Department in New Mexico. I'm the Training and Policy Bureau Chief.
Hi, Andrea. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Susan.
Okay, then let me move on to Region 7, which is Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas. Anyone on from those regions, those states?
Hello, Susan. This is Margie Poorman from the Iowa Department of Human Services Training.
Hi, Margie. Good to hear your voice.
Yours as well.
Thanks. Anyone from Nebraska, Missouri, or Kansas?
This is Jeff Adams, the training coordinator in Missouri Children's Division.
Hi, Jeff. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear you. Thanks.
Kansas or Nebraska? Okay. And so we'll move on to Region 8, which is Montana, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Any folks from Region 8?
This is Pam Bennett from Child Protection in South Dakota.
Hi, Pam.
Hi.
Welcome to our call. Anyone else from Region 8? Okay. Region 9, which is California, Nevada, Arizona, and Hawaii.
Hey, Susan. This is Lene Stout, California, the Chief of the Resource Development and Training Support Bureau. I have with me Jean Espill and Elizabeth Newby.
Great. Hi, everyone from California. Glad you could be on our call.
And this is Holly Sanger, the Training Administrator for the Division of Children, Youth, and Families in Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, Holly. I'm especially happy to hear your voice.
You were thinking I didn't speak up right away, weren't you?
Yes, Holly's one of our presenters, and I'm glad to know you're on the call. I had an email from Hawaii. No one from there could join our call today, and I'm wondering about Nevada. Okay, then let me move into Region 10, which is Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska. Anyone on the call from Region 10?
This is Mardell Nelson from the Idaho Child Welfare Partnership. Oscar Morgan, our Academy Training Specialist, will be joining us.
Thank you, Mardell. Glad you could join us today. Anyone from Washington, Oregon, or Alaska?
This is Kathy Ledesma. I'm the CFSR coordinator in Oregon. Hi, Donna. And the other people who are going to be on this call are all on another conference call. Hopefully they'll be joining us later.
Terrific. Terrific. I want to make sure that we sweep back through the states. Are there any state folks on the call that joined after we started the roll call? Anybody who hasn't had a chance to introduce themselves yet? Okay. Are there any Children's Bureau folks on the call? Donna Hornsby, anybody else?
This is Don Adams.
Hi, Don. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Glad you could join us.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other Resource Center folks on the call? I'm sitting here looking at someone, so now's her chance.
This is Maureen Baker from the Resource Center for Organizational Improvement.
Is there anyone else who is on the line that I have not introduced at this point? Okay, this is great. I think this is a wonderful cross-section of states and training administrators, and I really appreciate the time that you all took to be on this call today. We are awaiting Linda Mitchell from the Children's Bureau, CFSR unit, who was going to be our lead-off speaker, and she has been detained. So
no, I'm here.
Oh, Linda, you are?
Yep, I'm here.
Hello.
Hi, sorry.
It's okay. You gave me Angela.
Oh, sorry.
But I'm glad you're not detained, and I'm glad you are here. Did you come in for the roll call? We have folks from across the country.
I did.
It's a good, robust group. Before Linda starts talking, I just want to again remind you that this call is being taped. The audio file of this call will be available for downloading from our website, the NRCOI website, and that's www.nrcoi.org. And usually it takes a day or two for them to go up, but certainly you should feel free to share our website, which has a lot of other wonderful information on it, and we'll also have a downloadable file of this call for future reference. We hope that this call today will be informative and interactive. And in my little notes for getting ready for this call, I have the word interactive bolded. You'll see from the agenda that I sent out to you that after Linda, Holly, and Michelle talk with us for a few minutes about their experiences and share some of their lessons learned. We've left a lot of time for questions and discussions, so please feel free to keep track of any question that you want to have addressed or any comment that you want to make, and we will make sure that we get to it today before we hang up. So with that said as introduction, I'm going to turn the mic over to Linda Mitchell and have her start us off. Thanks for joining us today, Linda.
Okay, thanks, Susan. I thought I'd just divide up my discussion in three areas, talking about the statewide assessment, some of the things that we've been learning on site thus far during the second round of reviews that we conducted in 2007 and started in 2008, and then talk a little bit about, from my perspective, the role of training with regard to the on-site review, the statewide assessment, and the program improvement plan. As you know, the training systemic factor is rated upon three particular areas, and that relates to new worker training or initial training for staff. The second is ongoing training for staff, and the third area is foster parent and adoptive parent training. One of the things in the statewide assessment I think that is important for states to understand is that when we rate for the systemic factors, when we're working on the final report, we're using a combination of information from both the statewide assessment and what we learned during the on-site review. Therefore, it's really important for your statewide assessment to not only provide us with information about the systemic factor, and in this case, in training, but also to be evaluative. And I'm going to talk a minute about what we mean by that, because sometimes states are, in their statewide assessment, telling us a lot of information about how your system works, but not really telling us about how effective it is in meeting the needs of the staff or the children and the families that you're serving. So with regard, for example, in the area of training, when it's clear, it's important that you provide us with clear information about your training, the description, but also the effectiveness. For example, what are the exact requirements for new worker training and for ongoing training? And how do these workers meet the requirements? So, for example, do you have a set curricula that is in place for ongoing and new worker training? Do you use community resources? How effective are the trainings that you're doing? So, for example, especially those states that are county administered states and the local entities are responsible for their own training, it's really important for you to explain that in your statewide assessment and how you at the state level know whether or not that training is getting carried out at the local level and how workers access that, because it's different in every state. Even in some state-administered programs, training at the local level is very, very different, that you might have a statewide training program that's carried out by regional offices, but every regional office is different. And we go into a state, and the state may be saying in the statewide assessment, well, you know, the training is carried out by regional offices, and this is the requirement for new workers. And then we get out there and talk to workers at the local level, and depending on the region they're in, they may say, yeah, we get new training, but I was a worker for 6 months and started to carry cases before I was even able to get into new worker training. So it's important that you really understand how the training is getting carried out at the local level if it's a local entity that's responsible for that. The same thing with what I said about ongoing training requirements. Do you use have a set curricula? That some states do have set trainings for ongoing staff. However, in some states, it's just up to the staff to find their own trainings in the community to meet any sort of ongoing training requirements. So it's important for us to understand, when you're talking about ongoing training, how that is carried out at the local level. It's also important for us to know who tracks completion of the training and any consequences for not completing that training? How do you know when you say, for you know, our requirement is that ongoing workers must receive 30 hours a year of training? How do you know that the staff are getting that training? Who's tracking that? And that's one of the questions that we ask when we're on site. Also, we know that some states, we just came from the New York Review, and, for example, in New York City, the agency there has their own training academy, and they do pre- and post-tests, and if you don't pass the post-test, then you're no longer employed by the agency. So it's important for us to know, again, what the consequences are for non-completion of training or not meeting any sort of training requirements that you have, like pre- and post-testing. How do you know that the training is effective? Well, obviously, you know, states that do some sort of pre- and post-testing will have a sense of the effectiveness of the training, and it would be important for you to provide us with that information in the statewide assessment or any sort of evaluations that have been done of your training program and what the results were, including it might just also be information with regard to evaluations from staff as they've completed training or feedback from supervisors or other folks with regard to the effectiveness of training. And then finally, how do you determine training needs in your state? How do you make adjustments to your training based on what the needs are out in the field? And it would be important for us to know that as well. And these are some of the things that, as I mentioned, we're going to be asking when we're on site and conducting their review. And I think sometimes states, I'm trying to think of a word, if they're a little disappointed in the results, because they say one thing in their statewide assessment, but then when we get out there at the local level, we're finding out that what the state thinks is getting carried out at the local level may indeed not be getting carried out. And I think it's really important in the statewide assessment for you to really dig down deep with regard to the training so that there should be no surprises on site. And when we say to you, you know, there were some regions that we interviewed and the workers said that, you know, it takes them 6 months to 9 months to get into a new worker training when they're first hired, that should not be a surprise to you. You should know that before we come on site. I thought what might be helpful is if I go through some of the things that we've been learning in round two of the review, and I'm only going to talk about information from the reports that have actually been posted on the website. There are a couple of reports from 2007 that the states are reviewing right now and providing us with feedback, and they're not posted on the web, and I thought it would be unfair at this point in time to talk about those. But with regard to the reports that are available on the website from round two, five of the states were rated area needing improvement for initial training. Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't meet the overall systemic factor for training, but I'm just talking about the individual ratings on those three areas that I mentioned earlier. So five states are rated area needed improvement for initial training. Some of the things that we found in those states, why they were rated area needed improvement, for example, there are some states that contract case management out to private agencies, large amounts of the child welfare work done by private entities. And when we met with those private agency workers, they were not being trained. And then we had to sort through issues in some places around what are the training requirements for private agencies who are carrying out the work of the state or county locality, and who keeps track of that, and how do they access that training? Are they allowed to go to training that's done by the state or the county, or the private agency supposed to be holding their own trainings, and who's keeping track of all that? So that became an issue for some states that were contracting out, and that's something, if those of you on the phone have that situation in your state, you may want to start to take a look at that now, is if you're contracting out for case management to these private agencies to do the case management work of the state or county, how is it that those folks are being trained? in some instances, it was determined that the training, while it's occurring, is not really meeting the needs of the staff, and that was feedback, you know, from workers and supervisors that we interviewed that, you know, they were saying, you know, they go to training, but the training really isn't very good. It doesn't meet our needs. It's not updated, things like that. Staff not completing the full training before caseloads are assigned, whether or not that's by design and the agency knows it, or whether that's just happening because even though the state may say to the local entities and local offices don't assign caseloads until they complete training, you know, local sites might be overwhelmed and have to assign workers to full caseloads before they actually complete the new worker training. So again, when you go back to that statewide assessment, it's important for us to understand how long does it take to get through new worker training and how do caseloads get assigned? Are they assigned, you know, one case during their first month of training, if the training takes place over a period of time? You know, when do they get cases and what's the expectation? Because then we talk about that at the local level, and it would be important for you to know ahead of time the kinds of things that we may be hearing. And some states not ensuring that training is completed. Again, get to that question of who tracks completion of training. I know, like, for in Oklahoma, for example, we learned last year we did their review. They, you know, they keep track of who attends the training, and if somebody misses a training, they're right on it. Their supervisors get an email and their managers get an email. They're told so-and-so missed the training. They need to make this up, and if they don't make it up, they're you know, emailing the local office to make sure that those folks make up that training. So we need to know how that's being tracked, and that did impact the rating for some states. We also had five states that were rated area needing improvement for ongoing training. And as I mentioned, one issue that's not necessarily related to the rating but does come up a lot is that a lot of states don't have a set curricula for ongoing training, and staff have to get the training at the local level, like, for example, out in the community. They may select trainings that other groups are having. And, well, I think personally, from my experience in the field, that may be good. I, as a worker, many of you probably did too, went to trainings in the community, but I think it's important for state or county agencies to also have a set curricula so that you're making sure that staff are getting the training that you think is important over their course of employment. And I get a little concerned when I hear that, you know, workers are just kind of on their own to get that ongoing training and just quote unquote prove that they met the training hour requirements for a year. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that training is tied into what you all think is important for them to know and to learn about practice. What we learned from some of those states that were rated area needing improvement for ongoing training is that sometimes the ongoing training is not available across the state, that in some states they've decreased the training opportunities for ongoing training, and there was an unevenness, if you will, across the state and across the sites we were in. Some states do not have a minimum requirement for ongoing training, and that's concerning as well, that it's, you know, they say, well, staff do get training, but there was no set requirement for any minimum number of hours or courses that had to be taken on an ongoing basis. And then we had one state that has training requirements for ongoing training, but we learned through not only the statewide assessment but also when we got on site that 50% of the staff approximately don't meet that ongoing training requirement. And I just think, and what I'm going to say is common sense, and I feel like I'm stating the obvious, but, you know, we see the lack of training play out in practice. We see that lack of training play out when we review the cases and we realize that there are, yes, in some many states there are systems issues with moving children to permanency and things like that. But at the same time, if the staff really aren't well trained, that's going to show up in the practice and it's going to be reflected in the outcomes that we're finding in the cases. And then finally, the area of foster parent training, all states for the reports that are posted on the website met the requirement for foster parent training. And on that particular issue, too, I'll say, going back to the statewide assessment, it would be important for you to not only talk about the training requirements and how foster parents meet those requirements, but also how that works for relatives who are providing care in both the areas of whether they're licensed relative providers or whether they are not licensed. And if they're not licensed, do they have the ability to attend the training if they wish? Do you have any sort of specialized training for relatives? Have you adapted your foster parent training for relatives? And the reason why I say that is because of the growing number of children who are in relative care, whether formally through the foster care system or informally. We pick them up in the in-home cases, but you've informally placed them with relatives. And I think it's important for us to really pay some attention to how we're training and supporting relatives. Finally, one other area that I think is important for us to look at is how quality assurance is tied to training. And I think that over the course of the first round of reviews that more and more states developed quality assurance case review systems where you go out and you do your own monitoring. But one of the questions I always pose to states is, how is that tied to training? How do training staff get the QA results? How do they then use that to inform them about training in terms of improvements that need to be made or new trainings that need to be done? And I think that that's really key, and that's also really key with how the results of the on-site CFSR review get used by training staff as well. And then finally, I just wanted to talk for a second about from my perspective, the role of training staff in the CFSR process. I think obviously it's important for training staff to be involved in the statewide assessment. It's important for you, I think, to take some of this information that I'm giving to you today and to bring that back to your state as they're working on the statewide assessment and say, you know, we need to make sure we ask these questions. We need to make sure this information is in the statewide assessment, and we need to do some discussions with local staff so that we really know what's happening with regard to how training is getting carried out at the local level and how staff are experiencing that training and how staff feel it's effective or not effective. Secondly, I think it's very, very helpful when training staff are part of the on-site review team. I know like in Vermont, the District of Columbia, many states had their training staff and including some university staff if they have a partnership with a college or university, had them be reviewers on the review team. And I remember a woman from University of Vermont where they have a 4E collaboration, and she said that it was extremely helpful for her to be a reviewer on the team because she could take all that information about practice and realize where they were missing, what they were missing in training and where training needed to be strengthened. So I think it's very important for training staff to be represented on the on-site review team as state reviewers. And then finally, I think that there's definitely a role for training staff in program improvement. And, you know, I think it's more than just sometimes we get states, the training that they relate to the program improvement plan is really what I would call discrete kinds of trainings to implement various new things that they put in the PIP, like a state wants to work on concurrent planning in their program improvement plan, and then they have subsequently they put in their PIP to do some training on concurrent planning. Well, I think that's good. I still think that it's important for the states and the training staff to look at the results as a whole and look at, do we need to revamp our training, not just add new trainings on to carry out and implement things that you're putting in the PIP, but take this back to your new worker training and your ongoing training, your supervisory training, and look at the results and where you need to do some total revamps of your training curricula, I think is very, very important that you do that. So that's all I really had, Susan. Those were kind of my thoughts about the training part related to the CFSR.
Thank you, Linda. That was just a wonderful summary, and you made some points that I hadn't heard before, so it was extraordinarily helpful. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Let me now turn the call over to Holly Sanger, who is the training administrator for the Arizona Division of Children, Youth, and Families. Holly's going to spend about 8 to 10 minutes talking about briefly what her agency looks like and what the training looks like, but more importantly, focusing in on what their experience was with the second round of the CFSR. So, Holly, let me turn the call over to you.
Wow, I'm going to be talking a mile a minute for all that. Okay. Well, first, our state is Arizona, and so for those of you back east, it's very different because we're very large and spread out. Our division has six districts, which encompasses, I believe, about 12 or 13 counties. And we are state administered, but the districts are also quite independent. And so they also do some of their own things as well. So part of my task is to keep all of that connected and make sure that there's some consistency and that what the individual, perhaps, for instance, rural areas have different needs than the urban areas. So it's natural that they would be doing some things differently. Our training has to really encompass all of those kind of concerns. We do also have a somewhat transient population in Arizona because people come here and move here. We are growing in Arizona, and we do leave, and people leave. Similarly, we have, as I think most child welfare systems do, some retention problems. Our turnover is better than it was a couple of years ago. But somebody in one of the management meetings was commenting that the last round of the CFSR was actually reviewing the casework of probably an entirely different population of caseworkers. So we're looking at improving the system overall, but those individual caseworkers are not the same ones being reviewed, probably. So that's an interesting point. We also hire a mixture of backgrounds. We, because of our huge volume and that we need to hire, we cannot limit it to BSWs or MSWs. So we certainly seek out those, and we have some programs in partnership with the universities, but we also hire from related fields. So that also impacts training as well, as I'm sure you can imagine, those of you that do that. So a little bit about our experience with the CFSR. And then the other thing that I was going to say is that we have some pretty serious budgetary problems in our state. With the economy, our projected budget from the legislature has just been vastly different than it might have been. Interestingly, I came to this position as administrator only 3 years ago. Not even quite 3 years ago. So I was just barely even learning what a CFSR was. And they had been working on training was a point with needing improvement at the first round. And they had done some pretty significant revamping, at least as we call it, trying to turn the ship Titanic a little bit. So I've been working on continuing the turning of that ship. One of the significant things that I think that we've accomplished is, or are accomplishing, let's say, it's a work in progress. When I came on, training did not, and I've talked to some of you as other training administrators who have the same experience. It's just been wonderful that Susan gets us together. But training in the past and at the last round of the CFSR was pretty much just told what to fix. This is the problem, go fix it. And we didn't really have a seat at the table in terms of the CFSR or in terms of policy making or even on the initiatives that were happening. Training was not part of the development and the thought process going into it. And the practice improvement staff who did the statistics did an excellent job of it, but it wasn't really connected with training. So, it was connected, but not integrally. So probably that's been one of the biggest and most beneficial changes, I think, for our state, is for all of us to have those conversations. And my current management has been very supportive of me having a seat at the table, quite literally, probably too many seats for too many meetings. But I am involved at the beginning of the initiatives that happen. And so, for instance, this year when we completely revamped our child safety assessment and risk assessment and case planning process, myself and a couple of my training staff were involved from the get-go a year and a half ago. So we were able to both be thinking about and informing the group about what training would need to look like in order for our staff to be adequately trained on such an important thing. Let's see. You asked me to think about maybe what the biggest lessons were, and I would say the biggest thing that's still a work in progress is constant communication and a feedback loop. We really, management needs to value training, and that means both the highest level valuing the training department and then also the field management valuing training, so that they're, you know, in the past they were just told that, oh, that's the training institute, just go spend your 6 weeks and we'll really tell you how to do your job. And I think that's changing. We're seeing a change in the role that we play both in the field and with management. So that's been really pretty satisfying. Let me see. Our management now comes and gets feedback from the field at each of the new worker trainings. So they're hearing, as well as us hearing, what those new workers' needs are. And we have a regular monthly meeting between the policy department, which is more or less central office, the practice improvement department, and the training department, so that we can have, really, we have some pretty substantive discussions about changes that are happening in the system, people's needs, what's showing up in the case reviews. They implemented a formal QI training QI quality improvement system, so that we have that constant feedback loop. And even so, we still find that part of our role is to educate others about what training can do and what training cannot do. I think that this happens to everybody, that sometimes people think training is the only answer. And that, as we know, that may not be. So I see, it's interesting, but I've found my role to be not just running the department, but educating others and building relationships. I probably spend more time doing that and going to meetings, of course, but building relationships with our districts, with managers of the other programs, with the policy, with the practice improvement, with staff, so that there's a connectiveness. I tell my staff they need to stay connected with the field, so that they have credibility when they do stand up and train something. We've done a lot of improvements with our, you know, getting evaluations and information as to what people need, what can we provide to them that is going to meet their needs, and then that also comes back to us through the case review system. I would say that because it's a change, some people have really embraced it, and then some people have not embraced that because it is a change. And so training is kind of speaking up more than we have in the past. And I think the outcome is good, and sometimes we have to just keep remembering that we're all on the same team. We're all looking at the overall outcome for children and families. So I'm sure I'll be able to answer more questions that might stimulate other things, but I would say the biggest thing is to build relationships between the managing groups, the practice improvement, the policy, the upper managers, and then building relationships with the rest of the state, the district, and the people who are hitting the ground, because that's how we remain a vital, viable role. Is that kind of where you wanted me to go, Susan?
Holly, thank you. That was just wonderful. It really does reflect all of the hard work that everyone has done out there in Arizona and reinforces a theme that Linda raised, and that is, what's the link between training and policy and training and HR and training and QI, and how are they all fitting together? So that was perfect, Holly. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
And now let me turn the call over to Michelle Rosenberg, the training administrator for the Child and Family Services Agency in the District of Columbia.
Columbia. Good afternoon, everyone. I am from the District of Columbia, and which we're very different from all the other states. Every other state is pretty expansive. We're condensed. So all of our social workers and our managers and our supervisors are primarily in one building. We have a few outplaced in the community, and we're going to actually do that more so in the near future. So I think although we're all together, there's still that tension between training and regular operations, which I think is something that is relatively common. And so it's important to know that it is common. And one of the things, there's been a lot of discussion already about training, being at the table, inserting yourself, building relationships. Part of how I did that was making sure that I met with our director and the managers to talk to them about training needs, what the training plan was before, how we can fit information into the current one and bring them in early on with the needs assessment, and to inform them about the importance of training and how it needs to be there at the beginning of the process as opposed to the end of the process, and why. And then I realized that our agency didn't have a practice model, something that we had can talk about as a shared vision that we would support through training. So we really didn't have that grounding to say this is what training policy and practice is moving toward. So there was a development of that practice model. Now, when we talk about how does training play out in practice, it is more than just the classroom training delivery. And when our agency has, we do training, in my department we have new worker training, which is a combination of on-the-job training and classroom training. The training, we have four training supervisors and trainers that are actually under one program manager. So the transfer of learning process between the two is more natural, and they work very closely together in training our new workers over a four-month program. We have ongoing training for the rest of our workers and for supervisory management staff, and they're responsible. We have about 2,300 children in foster care. Half are served by the private agencies, and there's about 1,000 children in in-home care. And so we are responsible for training all the ongoing workers, and then we have foster parent training as well. So we're probably similar to the other states. The other important thing regarding how to insert yourself is then bringing information back to the managers and the supervisors about how they can support the training that their social workers received, and what they can do from a transfer of learning process. So we try to provide training to the supervisors to help them know what it is to reinforce. Now, that's a challenge because our staff, the idea about people have generally about training is that they're going to come out of training ready to go.
Okay.
And like all ready and a great package, and they don't need to learn anything else, and the supervisor is just going to do administrative kind of work. And that is not the case. And so we really do our best to try and educate the supervisors in how it's a continuum, and that their role is also one of educational support as well. those are some of the things that we've done. I want to just echo the link between HR and QA and all those pieces and being at the table and helping to also help people who are making decisions unpeel whether it really is a training issue or whether it's a policy-related question that needs to be changed or some other system question. And then when there's a need around training, to also look at, are the systems, are the computer systems, are the reports, do they support what's being learned in training? So there's that piece. So those were all things that we learned from first round CFSR to second round CFSR that helped us receive a better score. So I think those are some key factors that I wanted to talk about.
Thank you very much, Michelle. That was just great. There again is another. Your agency is another place where a lot of very hard, very difficult, very challenging work has been undertaken, and I'm so glad that you raised the topic of the practice model and the link between having a practice model that's articulated and defined and well-distributed and training's role in helping to get that incorporated and integrated throughout every single decision the agency makes. So thank you for bringing that up. We are now at the time in our call where we're going to open the mics and give you an opportunity to ask some questions of the three speakers or other colleagues that might be on the line. I would ask that as you're asking your question, would you please identify who you are and remind us of your state? But let me now just open up the lines and ask you to ask your questions.
Hey, ma'am, do you want all the lines open at once, or do you want them to come through one at a time?
Can they come through one at a time?
Yes, ma'am.
How do they tell you they have a question, Howard?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone.
Thank you.
Our first question or comment comes from the line of Ms. Hazel Parker. Ms. Parker, your line is open.
Hi, this is Hazel Parker from South Carolina. And Irvin and I are here, and we handle the child welfare training. I'm the training director of all the training, but Irvin handles the child welfare training. And my question is for I have a question for Michelle and one for Holly, and it's a simple question. I just want to know how your training is set up and how long it is. Holly made a mention of 6 weeks, but I didn't know whether that was actually what she had or not. I was just curious as to how it was set up and how you kind of roll your CFSR requirements into your basic.
We have a four-month training program, and that is, there's probably about 64, 70 days of classroom training, and it's alternates between on-the-job training. So we have our competencies, and we have the assessment process, and we have the practice model all very clearly stated as to what they are required to obtain by the end of their time with us. And then we haven't actually implemented it yet, but we're going to. There's a very pretty lengthy and comprehensive assessment of all the knowledge and the skills, because it's two different things when you're assessing for knowledge and skills. And then we're having a transition meeting between the training supervisor and the new supervisor about areas of strength and areas of needed continued support.
Okay.
And this is Holly from Arizona. I'm sorry, Susan had asked us to tell that, and I didn't do that. We have our new hires are in what's called a training position number, considered to be in training, a combination of classroom and on-the-job for 4 months, well, approximately 22 weeks, more specifically. And because of various different factors with the districts and so on, it's more condensed, so they have 2 weeks of pre-core where they do some shadowing, get a little bit of experience, and get started. just getting a sense of things. And then they come to 3 weeks of classroom training. We do have three different sites around the state. And then 1 week where they are back in the field with their unit supervisors and shadowing cases again. And we have a list of activities for them to participate in and complete. And then they return for 3 weeks in the classroom. And then when they go back to the field, there are what's called a field training supervisor. Sounds like the same thing Michelle's referring to, that is designated to help those new employees transition and work with their unit supervisor when they're out in the field. Most of them take a graduated caseload, not all at once, and their field training person and their unit supervisor are supposed to be doing on-the-job training with them during those training weeks. It's interesting that you raised the practice model issue, and I know Susan and I have talked about that. Our agency has, in effect, the practice model of the family-to-family initiative, if any of you are familiar with that, and it's basically family-centered practice. But we are still seeing the need for that to be articulated, because if you went and you did a survey, a lot of people, I think, would know that that's how we do business, but I don't think they could articulate what that practice model really is. So I'm having some conversations about that with different people, and that may be something that we are going to revisit. For the current time, our training is all geared around family-centered practice, the family-to-family initiative in keeping children more connected with their families and their communities. So that's what we work toward. We have competencies for them, but we're not at the point where we test them. We would like to get to that point, and that's kind of one of our next steps.
Thank you.
One question.
Irvin has one question.
Hello, Holly and Michelle.
Hello.
This is Irvin Bond. Do either one of you track the training as far as when CFSR comes in and asks a question, how do you track their training? How do you know these people were trained? When were they trained? How many hours were they trained? Ongoing training. Do you have a system in place that you can pull this information up? Because right now, we're trying to establish a database where we actually assign a training curriculum or a training plan for each employee to include basic training. Like our basic training is the child welfare services training. They have to get an additional 10 hours of related training hours, and then they have to finish what's called trial preparation. We have a judge and lawyers and stuff, and they prepare them for court. So that's our training plan for them.
Well, we have, which I don't think is the best because I think there's other training tracking systems that are better, but in our computer-based information system, there's a whole training module, training section. We input all the different training modules that staff are going through, and then we get the attendance sheets and change their status from enrolled to completed or no-show or whatever it is. And then we're able to pull up reports.
Okay.
We have the same. It's in our SACWA system.
Right. Ours is too.
Yeah. And then
right.
We can pull up reports. It's a little cumbersome. And some of us do, for instance, one of my training supervisors keeps track of the supervisor core attendees mm-hmm. on a separate Excel in addition to the SACWA system, just because the system's a little cumbersome.
Right. And we actually do that too. And I think it's not the best system. If you can find a real training tracking system that's actually able to give you real-time reports and able to do confirmations, you know, there's systems out there like that. And those are better than if they're built into they're built into the SACWA system, because there might be some limitations to that.
Our umbrella organization, which is the Department of Economic Security, has such a system as that you're talking mm-hmm. about.
What's the name of it?
Unfortunately, it's worse than our SACWIS mm-hmm. system. So
But, you know, Susan, I remember back when you had the conference in Denver.
Yep.
And there were a lot of people that were talking about training tracking systems. So.
Right. This is Susan from the National Resource Center. Irvin, if you want to send me an email, we did a quick scan of what are called learning management systems and or training tracking systems, and did a series of teleconferences on them with some child welfare folks across the country. And I have a list of the systems that are used by about 6 or 8 states, and I would be happy to send that, email that list to you. So just after this call, send me an email so I know where to send it, and I'd be happy to share that with you.
Okay, I have your email because you sent me the email, so I can get it. I'll get him the email address.
Perfect, perfect. Great.
Thank you.
No problem. Glad to help. So now we're looking for other folks to hit one, and they will be given the mic and have questions for Linda or Michelle or Holly.
Our next question or comment comes from the line of Ms. Mardale Nelson. Your line is open, ma'am.
Hi, this is Oscar Morgan, and I'm from Idaho, and I'm reporting for Mardale Nelson. She's out at a CFSR meeting, just had to walk out of this session, and I walked in the middle of it because we were working on a conference. I have a question for Holly from Mardale, and the question is, Idaho is in the same situation in terms of budget issues and funding issues, and we're really having some tough times with that in terms of what we want to try to accomplish and what we have the money to be able to do. And the question is, given that you had mentioned about that you had some funding issues, like we all do, our budgeting issues, how are you able to fund your programs there, or what kind of innovative things are you looking at to be able to overcome that budget problem?
Well, one of the things that we're trying to do is to partner more so with the university. We have a good university partnership, but we're trying to see if, and I'm just right in the middle of that right now, to see if we can to maximize the use of the 4E money.
Mm-hmm.
And have them assist us in providing the ongoing training piece. So that's in the exploratory stages. Another thing that we've done is rather than is to have our internal staff do like train the trainer and learn pieces that are that experts have done, and then partner with the districts in providing that. And they have to attend several times to be able to learn that. So
right.
We're doing some of that. It's pretty challenging.
Can I just add, too, we, for all our mandated training, we have a trainer approach because we found when I did the numbers, the cost effectiveness of it is much better than if you were going to have vendors come in to do the training.
Yeah.
And we've also done some, we've got some federal appropriations, but we've also have partnered with some other organizations that we've been fortunate. We've been able to partner with some other organizations that have provided some money as it relates to particular practice issues, and training then falls into one of those practice issues. For example, when we implemented our family team meeting process, training fell into that, and so we were able to get some funds to support training for that. But as if you're able to do some training of trainers, I think if you have your own internal trainers, I think that's one of your best bets.
Well, another benefit of that, too, is that, and we're just exploring an expanded version of that. We had from the National Resource Center on I think it was on Family Center Practice, do an engaging and assessing families 2-day training. And so I have several of my trainers that learned that curriculum, but we also invited designated people from each of the districts.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's a partnership, and then the advantage is they're right there in the field, and so they have immediate credibility with their own staff. And as long as it's a good, solid curriculum that they can learn and replicate, it's really pretty beneficial.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thanks for asking the question, Oscar.
Our next question or comment comes from the line of Mr. Jeff Adams. Mr. Adams, your line is open.
Thanks. I just wanted to say, Linda, Holly, and Michelle, really appreciate the information. It was very insightful and helpful, and it resonates with what we're dealing with here in Missouri. I guess my comment is that, you know, we've struggled with classroom versus on-the-job training, and I think we've worked really hard at, you know, getting good classroom and more skills practice in the classroom with initial and ongoing for workers and supervisors, making sure that the supervisor training links to the workers and vice versa. And we've done a good job, I think, from top down and down up selling that. Where we're, I think, still struggling is with the on-the-job training piece, whether it's done by the supervisor, the frontline supervisor, or a specialist or mentor, someone there that takes the lead on working with those staff in between the weeks of classroom and then beyond, you know, even after the first year and that kind of thing. And I guess my question is, how have you handled that, or how have you addressed the on-the-job training piece to know that you're getting consistency statewide? We've tried to look at the places where we think it's going well and then look about what, you know, what makes that go well. And, again, it seems like we're struggling with consistency to know that that mentor or supervisor are demonstrating certain skills for that worker, then to take a piece of that and then practice, but really trying to focus on core skills like running a family support team meeting, interviewing a perpetrator, all, you know, those types of things. And so I'm just wondering how you've approached that to get that continuum beyond classroom.
Well, one of the things that we've done for that was under my control, so I was able to do it, was create standards for the training supervisors. Even with the training supervisors in our agency, there was vast differences on how and what was emphasized and what was important. And we created together with the and we also brought in the ongoing supervisors, or that you would be the supervisors in the regions, or to that process to know what is it that they have to know by the end of training, and what are the things that we can, that they still need to, that we're able to still have them develop over time, and that they need to develop over time, because it isn't going to be something that they're going to absolutely, or that we know that they're likely to know. And so developing those standards and then having the manager check in and make sure that they are, whether they're the manager is shadowing, or to have some sort of a quality assurance approach to it, is helpful. So that was one way that we approached the consistency, was around standardizing what types of knowledge, skills, and behaviors we want to see the trainees or the social workers have at the end of the training program.
And in Missouri, we've developed an on-the-job training guide for the worker and the supervisor, mm-hmm. and it goes along with the classroom, and it's to reinforce certain things that have gone on there. But,
right.
it still seems like we have inconsistency where some people, you know, really take the time to make it a part of their daily interaction, and other people are like, well, that's really not my thing. You guys are supposed to fix them in class, you know, like you were talking about earlier. And, of course, we know that that's not the case. So, so that continues to be just a struggle, I think, for us. I think we're on the right track, and getting the frontline supervisors more involved, I think, is going to help. But it continues to be a struggle.
Yeah, this is Holly in Arizona. We essentially did the same thing that Michelle just described, and I would say that it has helped. It was a subpart, one of the many subjects of an audit list over the last 2 years, and so we also developed a system where it has a guide with it, and have done training surrounding that with the supervisors, and we track them when they come back in. They have to do a checklist. It's on the basics, and we recognize that rural is different than urban, so we tried to make it very basic, of the minimum things that people should need to get at during that on-the-job training. But I think you're right. The challenge is that you have individual personalities, and, you know, maybe as they come back in, if we find that there is, you know, if we analyze it and we find that there's this one area that just doesn't work with their workers, then I think that does become kind of a performance issue for those supervisors, because that's part of their expectations. But tracking it and getting that information back to them, you know, we're still working on that as well.
Yeah, and I would just add, we are too. I mean, I think this is a common problem, and I think there's Holly hit on it too. There's because it's a systems issue. So there's two other things that I think are important. One is having the leadership, whether it's you're at the regional administrator level, give the message that this is the kind of this is what they want to have, and not from a you know, authoritative approach, but just from a best practice outcome for families approach. And then also, if you can manage to get, and we're almost here in our agency, is some sort of, is to have the type of learning environment, something about it in their performance evaluation, whether they're supposed to support the new worker or the ongoing worker around quality practice. And then that has to be monitored and evaluated by their supervisor. But if it could also be supported not only from the very beginning, so when they come in and they're supervised, like you can really kind of get to new supervisors first. With new supervisors, this is the expectation. We're going to help you how to get there. We're going to support you. And then they're evaluated on it, and then it's supported by their managers. That will help a lot. But it's a struggle.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Jeff.
Our next question or comment comes from the line of Ms. Andrea Poole. Ms. Poole, your line is open.
Thank you. Actually, my question has already been answered.
Okay, I'll put you back into the queue. Our next question or comment comes from the line of Mr. Bruce Rollins. Mr. Rollins, your line is open.
Thank you. Actually, I have two questions. One, my first one is to Holly, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate a bit more about the strategy that you use with your senior management so that they don't see training as the fixer of all things. And then my second question I just want to throw out to anybody is what are people doing to ensure that workers are getting to in-service training after they've left the pre-service? Because that's a continual struggle that we have given caseloads and work assignments and court and everything else. So, Holly, if you could answer my first one and then anyone else who wants to take the second one, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. The second one's easier, so I'm going to answer a piece of that one first. The division established a policy that they need to have 24 hours of continuing education credit, and we made it broad enough to encompass the things that the standardized curricula that we provide here, but also if they did things in their district, if they went to a conference on their own that was job related, if they could submit those in-services or out-services to me for approval. So it kind of opened up, hey, you can get credit for the training that you are already doing to help you on your job. And for the most part, we've found that people, you know, when they have a little bit of freedom of choice and they do have some things available, that they have done that. And we just recently enabled our system to be able to track whether or not they have the 24 hours. So that's kind of on a new edge as well. And then you asked about educating the management. I think I learned in my master's degree to just be a good talker. and also teaching them, really kind of educating them. What I found the most helpful that they could grasp onto was the four levels of learning. The awareness, the knowledge, the skill, and the expertise, and then we also incorporate that in our supervisor training too, to just to say, you know, here's what we can do in core, and we can get them awareness, knowledge, maybe a little bit of skill, but they're not going to get a great deal of skill. They're not going to get expertise. Statistics show they retain 10 to 15%. So just kind of reminding those things in a gentle way, and every time they would talk about, well, you need to have more of this in core. I'm kind of a broken record, and I just remind people that that's a wonderful idea, and absolutely people need to learn that. We can plant the seed in core, and then we need to have an advanced training when they have a context. So I've done a lot of just kind of educating that if you cannot cram everything in the world into 6 weeks, and because people won't remember it until they've been out there working with families a little bit. So for me, it's just kind of been talking and educating and choosing the opportunity and being at the table. So when I'm sitting at the table and they talk about, oh, we've got to get out the information about this QI process, for instance, that's the most recent one. And so I volunteered to help write the training with the practice improvement manager. And so that, and then we also had a conversation with the management about what that training would look like and what it could accomplish, but what else would need to happen. So just kind of seizing the moment every time there's an education opportunity. I've been very fortunate in that I'm invited to quite a few management meetings, so that's really helped.
Okay.
You know, Bruce, this is Linda. I'd also raise the question if I'm at the table and concurrent planning is a big issue that comes up, and, oh, we need to do more training on concurrent planning. And some of the questions I'd be asking is, well, even if we train on it, how do you ensure that it's being used? Are the courts accepting concurrent planning, and are we reaching out to the courts and making sure that they're on board with concurrent planning as a policy and as a practice? And I'd start to look at some of the issues that they tried to push onto training and make sure that there are actually mechanisms in place that support the practice, whether it's policy or having the other entities, be it the courts or somebody else, at the table that's making sure that their end of the piece is being done too.
Oh, that's really true.
Yeah. I have a sense, Linda, I appreciate that. I have a sense of that we try some of that, although the court seems to have this thing where if it's somebody from Rhode Island training them on something, it can't possibly be any good. It has to come from somebody who's an outside expert.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and some of that is just building
struggle.
Building your own credibility of your training program.
Totally.
And right. And so how you package information about the effectiveness of the program or about perceptions that people have as it related to the training, or I don't know if you have your own trainers.
Yep.
But do you?
Yes.
Yes. So being able to, whether you're able to showcase them somehow or have them come in, sometimes what we had done in the past is to do an executive briefing of the training as well, and that a briefing to the executive staff or the senior staff, the managers, and that way it does two things. One, it not only provides them information about the training and that it's important, but it also gives your trainers an opportunity to highlight their skills. And the more that they're valued and the more that you create that value, then you tend to get a little more credibility. And that takes some time. It's like chipping away.
Okay.
The other thing I just wanted to say about the getting your staff to their mandated training, one of the things that I've done is periodically, maybe every quarter, my agency will actually give people their individual training record. And so they'll be able to track themselves how many training hours that they've done, and that we ask their supervisors to work that out with them. Now, sometimes that's successful and sometimes that's not. What I found has been most successful to get people to training is when it's connected to some sort of a practice initiative and you have leadership saying that this training is, you know, important, and you need, it's important that you go, and that it has their support. So having leadership support tends to help, I've found.
Okay.
That is, you could not underscore that more. That is just huge.
Mm-hmm.
We could see the difference between when there was a district that had that leadership support.
Okay.
For this safety assessment training that we did all last year. And then there was a couple of districts where the program manager just made like a 10-minute face-to-face and then went on their way, and they were just vastly different in terms of the reception and even the behavior.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bruce, for that question. Howard, I think we have time for one more if there's one more questioner on the line.
Okay, ma'am. Our final question or comment comes from the line of Ms. Sarah Gallagher. Ms. Gallagher, your line is open.
Thank you. This is Sarah from Vermont. I had a couple of comments
One is that in Vermont, our entire training staff is actually university employee. So we've the in-service program, the pre-service program, all of that is actually done in partnership with the university at this point. So I can't remember what state it was that's looking to expand that, but it's definitely at a time when state employee positions are being cut, we're actually growing for a bunch of reasons, but it's been really beneficial because the state doesn't have to put in as many dollars. It makes the dollars go a long way. So that's one comment I wanted to make. And the other is about, I mean, we may have a slightly different problem here in that we have very low turnover, and so we have a lot of very experienced staff and supervisors and district managers who are quite comfortable in sort of an old case management model, and the department is very much shifting to a more safety-organized, family-centered, solution-focused casework model. And so what we found is that we still do the new employee training in a central location and a little bit of core, but most of the training that we're doing at this point, we're doing out in districts, and we're training whole teams. Mm-hmm. Because what we found is that when you have an employee come from an existing team and come into an in-service training, and then they go back, and they just it doesn't really change their behavior, especially if their colleagues aren't getting the same information and if their supervisor isn't. So any training initiative needs to start with the leadership and the supervisors getting on board, and then we found it much more helpful to train whole teams of people so that, and then we go back like repeatedly so that they're practicing skills and they have homework in between, and we're sort of building on what they're learning and the skills they're developing as a whole team.
I would echo that, too. That's how we did this safety assessment rollout, this Holly, and it was really, people have said that it was much more effective than any initiative that's been sent out before, and they, frankly, they just appreciate us driving down to Benson, you know.
Yeah, right, you know? Same thing.
Yeah, I think that's very effective. It's kind of because we're, although we're all in one area here, we're trying to do more unit-based training. So it's so going where our trainers actually go into the units, and they can work on a smaller scale around particular practice areas.
Yeah. Then the other thing we found too is that as this whole transformation process mm-hmm. moves forward, is that old issues in the system, like the administrative team in an office, will have all these issues that have been festering for a long time, and they all come to the forefront.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Then we've been spending a lot of time just consulting, doing team building work with management teams and district teams, and so we've sort of branched out beyond training to a lot of consulting.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Sarah, thank you so much. I'm glad you joined the call, and I really appreciate you sharing that. I think I'm starting to hear, this is Susan, from training administrators across the country that they really are now beginning to think about classroom and beyond mm-hmm. for training, and you've certainly not only thought about it but started implementing it. And so thank you for sharing that. That was very helpful. I hope we didn't have a lot of people on the call who didn't have their questions answered, and because we are now just about out of time. Howard, is there any way you can open up all the mics so everyone can talk? Because I want to ask the group a question.
Yes, ma'am, just a second.
Thank you very much. I'll ask the question, and then you can respond. This call and the response from the training managers and administrators across the country seems to have been, at least from the Resource Center perspective, extremely helpful and productive. And I'm wondering if there is a desire or an interest to have periodic calls for child welfare training administrators where we might have presenters like we had Linda and Michelle and Holly today, or we might just open up the lines specifically for the training administrators to talk with each other. As many of you know, we do run a peer training network, which is open to anyone who does child welfare training or has an interest in it, and we have a lot of folks on that call. We do calls quarterly, and the topics are varied and they're very interesting, but I'm wondering if folks think there is a need to get this group back together, and or what did this call satisfy what you wanted? So just kind of say, do you think we should get back together again?
Yes.
Does anybody want to say no? Or you've probably already voted with your hang-up if you have. That's great, and I'm happy to have our Resource Center coordinate a periodic call. I would ask if you have ideas now for what you'd like the topics to be, to let me know. Just sort of yell them out, and Maureen and I'll take them down. And if you have the opportunity to reflect for an hour or so or a few days and want to send other topics, let me know. Anybody have anything come to their mind immediately?
Working with the senior management staff to implement the process of training.
Okay, so you want more on how you interject the training system into leadership.
Right, and get the executive staff on board to implement those changes when sometimes they're kind of hesitant because they don't really understand training.
Yep, excellent topic. I think we could talk about that for days. Good one. Other ideas?
And this is Oscar
in
Idaho.
Go ahead.
And I think Mardell would agree with this. It was a great discussion in terms of, you know, alternate funding and dealing with budget issues and things like that. But we continue to get hammered, and I appreciate the information that came out. But I'd like to have even more discussion on that because I'm sure it impacts all of us.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Oscar.
This is Jeff in Missouri. I would like to talk more about how we sequentially build the training in the classroom and on the job. So there's certain skills that happen first, second, third, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I would just say that, you know, right now in our division, I think people feel trained to death because between what we do, the department does, outside agencies, that kind of thing, it seems like we compartmentalize a lot of this ongoing type stuff, and we need to train smarter and not just more of it. You know, so I think how do we get, you know, to a place where we are doing more with less, if that makes sense.
It certainly does, Jeff. Thank you so much for suggesting that. The Peer Training Network is going to be having a call on that topic probably sometime in early September. And what your comment has suggested to me is I need to make sure that everyone who is invited to this call, whose email I have, also gets invited to all our Peer Training Network calls. Because there might be some topics that the broader group would want to discuss, and then we might find, I think, alternate funding and working with senior managers are topics specific to training administrators. But how do we sequentially build skills, and what competencies do we expect folks to have when they come out of training, the core, and what can we get done service, I think is something that would engage a larger audience. So I will make sure that everyone who I sent an email to invite you to this call today is also invited to our Peer Training Network calls, too.
I'm interested in finding out what's offered to the trainers to help build their skills.
Training of trainers. Excellent.
I'd also like to know how other training units across the country operate. Like, do they have policy and procedure manuals for just the operations of the training unit?
Okay, great.
This is Bruce Rollins. I'd like to know a bit more about the curriculum development issues for those states who are beginning to shift their case management to non-department employees.
Okay. Well, we've carved out several ideas for calls, and we'll keep ourselves busy organizing this. I am open through email for anybody who would like to send me additional ideas. I want to thank you for joining this call. It was certainly interactive. It was certainly, I think, highly informative. I want to thank especially Linda and Michelle and Holly for their willingness to come on and open themselves up to this group and share what they learned. And I think that their expertise has and will enable us all to think about training in a different way. And I think that's wonderful. So thank you very much, everyone. I appreciated you joining our call.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect.